Welcome to the Out of the Woods podcast, the top five headlines threat hunters need to be thinking of this week.
Hey everyone, welcome to a weekly edition of the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. This is Scott Poley here with Lee Arkinall.
Welcome everyone, thanks for joining.
And this weekly segment features the top five stories that threat hunters need to be thinking about, as well as our thoughts on the subject and hunting strategies. So with that, let's dive into the top five threat hunting headlines for the week of April 22nd, 2024. So Lee, I was going to start off with something I always find interesting, because of the context of the article. But basically, the NSA has pushed out guidelines at like the media.defense.gov, which is the CSI deploying AI systems securely. And basically, it's the recommendations for if you're going to have an AI system, what should you do or be thinking about for securing it? And why I love these types of things so much is not really much strays from what you should be doing in security in general, right? Like, if you looked at the best practices across all security stuff, it's all here. Some of like the high hitters, right? Like, you know, make sure the sensitive data is encrypted, you know, isolate and filter, kind of a zero trust architecture, control access with minimum access, make sure you're patching things, make sure you're doing monitoring. And then they even talk about even getting into some of the training of the people that interact with or maintain. But there was one exception, and it kind of is unique, but also similar to some other things you may consider protecting. And that is, they talked about weights, right? So when you look at AI systems, the models aren't always the bread and butter to the system itself. A lot of times it's the training that went into those models that actually holds a lot more value. And what that training does is, it basically helps the model assign weights to different data points so that they can make accurate decisions. And so once you determine what these weights are, it's kind of like your secret sauce almost for that model. And they kind of call out the weights independently to make sure, one, there is good integrity so no one can manipulate the weights, because that could obviously cause some problems. But two, you don't want to lose the weights, for instance, as far as someone stealing data or being able to like do certain things to the system to kind of determine what those weights are, make some assumptions. And, you know, I thought that was a really good call out. I thought it was really interesting, but then it also made me think very similarly when they started mentioning, yeah, for protecting weights, like look at the hardware level and what hardware can actually request like the keys essentially. And it was kind of like how you would look at protecting cert authority certs. Right, if you have a specific high privilege certificate that is used to sign all your stuff, that's usually what you protect. Almost a lot of times people keep them offline even. And in this instance, obviously the weights necessarily can't be offline because the model is going to be using those as it is running or performing whatever it's supposed to perform. So it's a little different thing you'd have to solve, but it sounds like they approach the defense solution similar to that of how you protect a CA cert. So I thought that was really interesting. But, you know, this kind of goes back to something I've always had some rumbling with, and that is, you know, you look at compliance stuff in general. I always feel like a majority of the chunk of the compliance stuff is just good old-fashioned security, right? There really shouldn't be so much differences between what you do in security for, say, you know, HIPAA versus PCI versus SIP or whatever compliance regulation you're abiding to. A lot of that really does overlap. There's just some nuances based on what's the most important thing, like protecting what data you're trying to protect or what system you're trying to protect. So, you know, it just kind of shows how security best practice stuff really covers on everything. And I really wish there was like a common guide to here's what everyone should do in general. And you have to comply to the general things. And then if you follow within these sectors, here's the few additional things you have to do, because sometimes people take on the burdensome where they try to like read between the lines too much for the most common security practices. So that was my little tangent, but yeah, I don't know what you thought or anything else stood out to you when you kind of saw like the regulations or how you should protect AI systems in general.
No, I kind of came to the same conclusion. And I know you understand the world of AI a lot more in depth than I do. and I came to the same conclusion where, besides the specific tasks associated with protecting the AI ecosystem in general, it sounded exactly like the steps you should be taking whenever you're rolling something new out. I mean,
right.
You know, update and patch regularly, conduct audits, monitor, and add to awareness training. I mean, unfortunately, and I don't mean to be like a doomsdayer, but unfortunately, with organizations already struggling to maintain...
Do those things in general?
and talking about what is the CIS standards, the top 20, mm-hmm. right? The maintaining hardware inventory, software inventory. I think this is just going to add to that landscape. It's going to add things that function into organizations that could slip through the cracks and could miss patch cycles. And I hope that's not the answer. I hope that isn't what happens. But if we're already struggling to do that, adding something more to the picture could end up hurting. Granted, I get there's plenty of capabilities for AI to improve processes and procedures within an organization. And I think that it is a very good addition. I just hope that it's not another burden to those teams that have to deal with this normal upkeep of it. I am glad that they brought this up. I will say, I'm wondering if the fumble that was everyone migrating to cloud at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
And the problems that we're dealing with now had something to do with this, but I hope the people that need to read this do eventually read it and understand it and get things everything or get things where they need to be. But yeah, it sounds like, hey, take the same proper precautions and steps that you would for rolling out a new application within your organization. So I hope it's not a burden, but good article.
You know, yeah, it's good because it just shows to be a security professional, you really just have to have the understanding of the things to consider. Now, the specifics on how to do those are where you really need to spend your time and effort as far as building your skill sets and understanding. But if you could just be aware and know kind of the big general areas of security, you'd actually be okay with any new problem you face because you can approach it kind of the same way, which is nice. But you do kind of bring up when you mention the cloud, I like the, cloud became a thing. Everyone wanted to use the cloud. Security was kind of a little unknown to the cloud. And then, attacks kind of would happen involving the cloud. People got better with security of the cloud, but I still feel like there's some additional things that are going to happen there with the AI systems and things. Obviously, there's not a ton of like attack technique type stuff with the cloud. I know there's some matrices out there, but that's not a common place where attackers are spending their time. And it's going to be interesting because there probably will be an attack surface there in the future that we'll have to kind of standardize our approaches from security professionals to handle and deal with. But it's going to be interesting to see how that evolves too, right? So similar to how you mentioned the cloud.
I mean, I think one of the biggest worries or biggest questions that we hear either from threat hunters or security operations teams is how do we detect manipulation of our AI, of our algorithm or the data that's involved? Like, that I hope that will come with it. I hope that they maybe some organizations understand that already, but I just hope it works out. I just hope it doesn't turn into that migrate to cloud thing.
Yeah, they rush too fast and then they end up falling into some pitfalls and problems they don't know how to solve.
Yeah.
So what do you got?
So I have this awesome article from SecureOnX Threat Research Team, which ironically, before the podcast, I'm going to share this. Is you are happy to say that, hey, we didn't have any DLL sideloading mentioned today. And I brought a whole article about it. granted, it's a technical overview, but it's a very great resource that if you're ever wondering anything about DLL sideloading, about what it is, how it can be abused, why you should be worried about it, this is it. I love the authors. They approach it with a educational approach. They're not assuming that their audience has full knowledge of this. So the first thing they do is they lay it out on the line about what DLL sideloading is. And they said sideloading that it occurs when an attacker places a malicious DLL with the same name as a legitimate DLL in a location that is searched before arriving at the legitimate DLL's path. So when the application runs, it subsequently loads the attacker's DLL in place of the legitimate one executing the malicious code. So normally, you know, a program would be looking for DLLs sometimes like in the Windows System 32 directory. But if the program or application is actually designed to look someplace else first, then how adversaries can abuse that is by putting something in that location, whether it be a registry key location or a file directory. Because oftentimes, one of the tactics they use, they'll drop an executable and a DLL in the same directory and have that application or that executable look for the DLL in the directory first. And if that happens, then whatever that DLL is crafted to do, it will do. A big problem that this raises is that this can normally, or this can sometimes bypass alerts or detections, because normally, and in a lot of instances, the application that is being abused or is vulnerable is signed and trusted. So it doesn't look like the executable itself isn't bad. It's doing what it's supposed to do. But the adversary has placed the malicious DLL in a place that that executable will execute it first. Then they go further and they provide real-world examples of malware that has used this technique, which, and I'm sure you're surprised by this, is a very extensive. You know, they link to the MITRE tag matrix as well, so you can check out all their documentation. There's a lot going on about DLL sideloading. It's constantly abused. Also, they provide an example of DLL search order hijacking as well, which is another DLL or a technique to abuse DLL or DLLs and applications. And as you scroll down, they provide even more resources. They talk about different event logs that you can look at, like Sys1 Event ID 1 or 4688, antivirus, EDR logs, Windows application logs. They give you the resources that you need to look at this type of stuff. So they're not just saying, here it is, Secure Onyx protects you from it. You know, they're saying, hey, here's what we found in our lab. Here's the research we've done. Here's the attacks we've seen. And if you don't have our product, here are things that you can look for, which is, I can't explain this well enough or find a word that provides how grateful I am, because a lot of the times, vendors are just like, we're the solution to your problem.
Yeah.
I just love the fact that they're like, nope, here's some resources that you can look for if you don't have us, which is a really good outlook in general. But then they go on and they even provide a threat hunting query that contains a lot of DLLs that I guess have been abused in the past, which are, which is pretty neat. Once again, a very long list. They cite all the resources that they have. Great article, great citations, and great pivots that you can use throughout the entire article to find out more information. So to rain on your parade, what was your perspective?
So, I thought it was a great resource to talk about DLL sideloading. The one thing I wasn't super excited about, and I didn't like read this into in depth, but it didn't seem like it stood out, like what is really going on when it comes to DLL sideloading? Like, what is it the attacker is trying to take advantage of? As far as the ways they can possibly get DLL sideloading to work. And I don't know if anyone's ever tried to run a program or a script that you need to call on another file, right, for anything, because it's a similar problem, right? So if you write a simple script that's going to read in a file, if you don't provide the exact path to that file, it just looks for it adjacent to where that script or program is running from, right? So DLL sideloading is the same thing. If the executable isn't defined where to look for that DLL, that's where it looks first. Is there a direct path that I'm supposed to go to fetch this DLL? Not available. It looks adjacent to itself. If it doesn't see the DLL it's looking for by name adjacent to itself, then it falls back to the System 32. And that's where attackers can take advantage of if a programmer, you can call it lazy programming, but if they don't specify specifically what DLL and where it's supposed to be, you run into some of those problems. Now, that being said, even if a good programmer puts in a direct path and an attacker is able to manipulate that path and replace the DLL, you know, for instance, that also can, you know, be a mechanism to even get around good programming. But the other thing I liked, I did like how they called out some of the detection stuff, because kind of how I look at this, because most cases, at least we've seen recently, is someone's going to run an executable, but they're going to bring alongside the DLL. So the executable and the DLL are going to drop in the same location. So from that, one, you can just look for what DLLs are being loaded, you know, with, I think, Sysmon event ID 7 is image load. If you're using Sysmon, you can look for DLLs that are loading that aren't from program file directories or System32 or Sysfile64, because it would be more system-specific DLLs. So if you see that activity happening, it's something you could look into, especially if you're able to actually correlate where you have an execution and that executable path is the same directory as that DLL load by that same process too, because you can tie those together with process IDs. So that's another way to kind of look at this. They did have an interesting hunting query that they provided, and I'm assuming it's in their tool. But the one thing I didn't like was it kind of got back to like the problem with IOC-based things, except for DLLs, you can't really change the names. But they, I guess, went through like, what are all the DLLs that have been used maliciously that have been loaded in? And they're saying, let's just look for these names being loaded. And then basically saying, and they don't belong in these parent directories like the ones I mentioned before, which is System32 or Sysfile64. So I'm guessing those are all the DLLs that do exist on system. They're like the common system DLLs they pulled out. So not a bad hunt, but I hate how that's like a hard list to potentially maintain as things could change. And you're also missing almost all the DLLs that are kind of being leveraged today, where they just pull in a common DLL that's supposed to be with the program file. So that someone will find some third-party tool, they know it loads a DLL that was written for the tool, so it has nothing to do with system-level DLLs. So if you use that kind of hunt, I think it's a great hunt, but it doesn't cover a whole spectrum of, you know, how this attack just continuously happens. That being said, you know, something worth looking at, they kind of understand, but there's, I think, more you have to do there. But a really good write-up as far as giving really good examples, showing the significance and relevance of DLL side loading and why you should care. And they, like you said, they did more than just saying, hey, we have a tool that can help you solve this. They kind of gave you the whole workup on their solution to the problem. So you can kind of see how they thought about it too. So very cool.
And one thing I forgot to mention was another resource, or I guess a tool that's out there that I've used in the past, not for specific side loading. I think it was actually during some user account control bypass technique research that I was doing. But Microsoft SysInternals ProcMon, or Process Monitor, if you run it and you focus on an app, like if you turn it on, you get it running, and then you click on an application, it'll actually show where it's looking. So you could follow the path of the calls that it's doing to see where it calls first. So if you do, or if you run it and you see that application is looking at the directory that it's running from first before going to System32 or wherever, go ahead and test it out and put like a text file named something.dll in there and see what it does. See if it will look there first and touch it. Granted, I haven't tested that theory out. I don't know if it'll actually run anything or just look at it and say, no, I can't use this and move on. But it's a nice tool to get that visualization of what's going on with it. Just one last plug. All right, what's the next article?
Yeah, so this one was another one that's not technical, but I think a very interesting topic. It was from the record.media, basically titled NATO New Military Civilian Cyber Center in Belgium. But basically the idea here was, we all know NATO is a group of allied countries that basically try to say they will work together to resolve conflicts around the world, or kind of be a single force, right? And they're there to protect each other. Well, one of the things that's been really hard with cyber in general is cyber, there really are no borders for a lot of cyber-based attacks. And so being able to, I don't want to use the term regulate, but be able to investigate and respond, that makes it very difficult in some instances, especially like we know a lot of actors will kind of proxy traffic through potentially different countries and things, just to make the investigation even harder to do, because if, even if government were to get involved, for instance, to try to deal with the issue, they would have to get the cooperation with another government, and potentially how many chains where that traffic goes through, that that could create a lot of time and a lot of resources for something that they would then deem as not worthy at that point. And I thought this was an interesting response because it kind of made more sense based on where war fronts are going to be going, but also just cybercrime and other cyber issues in general, kind of having a collective group like the NATO-esque, but for cyber. And that's what it was about. You know, and they make a big call out too, where they talked about how this really isn't just for like war times, because the whole point isn't to solve wars and deal with wars. It's really just understanding that there's cyber attacks going on all the time and what kind of things can they help with and regulate with. Because, you know, cyber crime used to be a problem because people were just making money and it was kind of like any kind of crime problem. But now ransomware is really up the ante. And this might be one of the reasons why this became a response, because ransomware is doing damage, and it's not just affecting countries, it's affecting civilians, right, for services and things they may rely on or may need. So that's kind of like one of the discussions and responses potentially for that. But it also makes things really interesting too, because if you are aware of how ransomware groups kind of have operated for some time, they're kind of harbored in Russia for a reason, because Russia, as long as they don't hit Russian targets, they kind of don't mind if they operate out of Russia, as long as they're affecting, you know, Western or NATO or outside Russian-speaking areas. And so that's kind of the agreement. Now, if this goes into place, I don't know what that means, right, as far as what's the response now, if now they wanted to, say, go after some big ransomware group that may be harbored in a state that doesn't fall under NATO. There might be some challenges there, and it might be some pressure points. But either way, I thought it was an interesting topic because, you know, that's the one thing that's hard about writing legislation for cyber, is government has a hard time understanding that you can't just say, well, no cyber crime can happen here, we pass the law. But if the attack's not part of this country is passing the law, it's not really the same or enforced the same. So this is, I think, the right approach. It's going to be interesting to see what it really looks like and how they handle things where, what if you don't belong to NATO, for instance? So yeah, I don't know what your take was on it.
I will say props to whoever was in charge of naming this, getting as close to secure as possible with the S-A-C-E-U-R.
Oh yeah.
I mean, I saw that and I was like, well, I mean, it was a good attempt with what they had to deal with and what they were calling it. So, okay. But I do feel like this is a good effort to help countries, or it's a good step, not only uniting the effort to help countries that need it, but an opportunity to learn from each other. This is kind of like one of those, I don't know if you would say like a global think tank kind of deal. In my opinion, this seems like it's bringing all these great minds together to work on a single problem, which, I mean, I don't mean to relate it to World War II, because, I mean, clearly, we're not there. Hopefully we're not there, or we'll never get there. But there was a lot of great minds that came to help solve that problem as well. From all over, you know, it was, getting the best thinkers there is always helpful. Ironically, it's funny that you brought this up, because I had just listened to one of my favorite podcasts, which is Malicious Life, starring Ron Levy. And it's specifically, the episode is titled, Can You Bomb a Hacker? In this episode, they detail the problems that are being faced when determining who, during a war, is a combatant and who is a civilian. Now, that may seem easy from the physical world. If you think about, if soldiers are marching down your town that they may have just invaded, and you're a civilian, you're protected by the Geneva Convention to a degree. Right, not, you're not supposed to be a military target. You're not supposed to engage in conflict to maintain that civilian identity. If you would grab a weapon or a gun from a fallen soldier and engage whoever's around you, then you give up that identity of a civilian.
Mm-hmm. You're a combatant.
You're a combatant now. So if you get away with it, or if you get shot, you know, you're no longer an innocent civilian. You engage. The problem is translating that to the digital world. should you be considered a combatant if you would, say, take part in a DDoS against your enemy, right? And first of all, it's tough to sometimes track people down to their their local position and IPs, but it can be done sometimes, especially if someone slips up. But they actually had something called eEnemy, which is a tool that the Ukrainians can use that you can kind of report soldier location. So if you do see, or if the Ukrainians do see Russians moving in, they can take pictures. They can do latitude, longitude, whatever the case might be, and it will report to the government. Now, the question there comes with, well, if they're endangering those lives, where does that put them? Because, and I don't know the answer, and I don't really have a...
Really, that falls under, like, spy law, right? Like, they are soon to be then an informant.
Right. But, I mean, but at the same time, I mean, okay, back in World War II, the spies, and I want to go back there just because it's the easiest, because it was all before all this social media stuff, right? You had spies, you had cells that were implanted in the locations, passing intel and stuff like that. But those were actual spies. If someone would take a picture of Russian troops,
like they don't realize they're actually being a spy, yeah.
What if they don't report to the government? What if they just put it on Twitter? Is that making them a spy, or is that adding them to the list of people that can do in military intelligence? And they have a good discussion about it. I would definitely recommend going and listening to it. I don't think they came up with an answer, because it's still a problem that we're facing.
I was just say what I thought was really interesting was you were talking about, if you're a civilian and you pick up a gun in the middle of a conflict, then it kind of turns you into a combatant and the rules change. But I know, like, the Second Amendment in the United States with, like, right to bear arms, they've used that as also towards, like, cyber tooling, right? They can be used for bad. But you're like, well, same thing. You have the right to bear arms. That kind of falls under that purview, essentially. And so if you bear cyber tools that can do destructive things, like, what does that mean, and where do you draw that line, and can you look at it the same way, considering that, for instance, everyone's home computer and pretty much any device has the ability to encrypt things, and they have libraries on it to do so. So theoretically, it all could be used as ransomware if just run properly, right? So it's just like there's a weird conversation to kind of have to say, how do you vet, or how do you process, like, where do those lines draw? Like, it's interesting because, we talked about borders and countries, and now you're getting to where do you draw the lines on the individuals and cause, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, I think they even end the episode with, does it seem harsh to kill people over hacking? Maybe, but there's no clear rule against it. Even if the person responsible isn't in a terrorist group or a military, but is just some guy in his apartment. So think about...
Well, Israel did a kinetic strike, right, for hackers? They're the first ones, I think, to ever do it. They bombed out a building they thought a hacker was attacking them from.
Yeah, so where's that put it? Is that justified?
Right. And that was even before all the conflicts that are occurring now. So it was even kind of a weirder, like, oh, that was a extreme response, or...
Yeah, it's just a weird or a complete gray area. Mm-hmm. Because think about, like, a DDoS. If you shut something down and communications are lost, or energy is lost, and lives are lost because of it, are you now on the hook for those lives?
Right.
Or
right.
If you do, spread ransomware or other organizations, communication, energy, government stuff, if they're locked out and they can't, and people die, are you responsible for it?
I think it'd be similar to manslaughter, right? Where you're not, like, your intentions aren't like, you're targeting specific people, but if you're harming people, I think you can still get charged with something like manslaughter, in my opinion. That's just my opinion.
And I agree with you, because if someone would ransomware a hospital, mm-hmm. and people would die because of it, I would hope that they...
Some accountability.
They, Yeah, because it's losing human life from a cyber attack. But great podcast, great article. I hope this solution comes soon.
Yeah, it's interesting to see how they develop it. Now, just like anything, it can be built the wrong way, and then we'll be cursing it, saying this is just Big Brother 2.0 kind of thing, and that's not what everyone wants. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So, what do you got next?
Next up is a good resource. I actually really, really like this. I found this last week when I was doing some, while I was messing around. But it's called book.hacktricks.xyz. And the first thing I did when I got there, I'll tell you, the first thing it reminded me of was another resource called, and I believe it's, is it Red Dot Team or I.Red Team? Let me see real quick. I have in my bookmarks. I should have definitely found that. iRed.team, which is another resource of penetration testing and what they like to call offensive security. And they also have reverse engineering forensics and other topics that they talk about. But it tells you, or it covers some, you know, tactics, techniques to gaining access to the things that a pen tester would need. When I came across HackTricks, the first thing on the top left was their HackTricks values and frequently asked questions. So, of course, I want to figure out who this is. You know, what are they talking about? And one of the first things that they say is that these are the values of HackTricks project to give free access to educational hacking resources to all internet users. And they also want to store awesome hacking techniques that the community publishes, giving the original authors all the credits. So they don't want any credit from other people. They're being very transparent about this, which I always appreciate, because whenever it does come time to, you know, getting promotions or publishing something, or, you know, the person has spent a lot of time and effort into creating this resource, and people nowadays can easily just grab it, modify, and call it their own. And it's hope. I strive to do this during my trainings, during the workshops and everything that we do. So it's good to see another person out there like that. But on the left, I started scrolling to figure out, okay, well, what's the actual content here? It starts with generic methodologies and resources. Then it talks about Linux hardening, Mac OS hardening, and Windows hardening. I was like, wow, like, okay, I thought this was just going to be pen testing. You know, straight out the gate. But it's not. It gives you a lot of resources to not only figure out how you can hack things, but how you can improve it as well. So it gives you kind of the best of both worlds. And then as you scroll, which I had a lot of, or there was a lot of stuff to scroll through, they give you even more resources like cloud security, hardware physical access, and binary exploitation. Reverse engineering, you name it. And after all these resources, I think the thing that I found most impressive was that they have a to-do section at the very bottom, which just tells me that they are thinking about constant improvement. So they didn't just make this a resource and say, all right, we're done. You know, we've covered everything. They're always looking for more stuff. Which makes that a living document in my mind that you can constantly come back to this place. This should be updated, you know, should have more resources if you were ever to go through all of them and exhaust them. But it's nice. The one thing I would really like to see, and this is, I guess, just selfish from my end, and to complete this or to make this even more complete resource, is to have a section for like security operations center analysts and threat hunters. Because I know there's a lot of resources out there, free resources that you have. Once again, the workshops that we do are always free to our users. So if adding that in and building a threat hunting and security operations center analyst section, I think would just be the cherry on top. But what was your take?
So, yeah, I love this resource. I've used it before, actually a lot. So even when I was starting out here at Cyborg, I used this a lot because of I knew the things I wanted to hunt for, And I know we spend a lot of efforts on emulation, and that was the thing I wanted to be able to figure out, how to emulate in the simplest manner as possible, one for time efficiency, but also to make it all reproducible for other people to emulate the same behaviors to validate their hunts. So I use it a lot for that, but what was also really cool, when you dig into a lot of different methodologies, a lot of them also include, hey, so you do this, you can see that it's working, look at these Windows logs, or SysModelLog will have this. So they actually have a lot of defensive things buried in there for the different techniques and things that you're actually going through and testing, which I thought is really good. But also, because they're grabbing basically the most popular or common ways of getting things done offensively, I think it's a great resource to where, even if you were to sit there and dabble and play, it'd be good to see, well, how mature is your security stack as far as, do your native tools, processes, and alerts detect any of this stuff? Because these are really common, and it's really, they make it really easy to at least test and verify that. So it's worth checking out, even just from that perspective, as well as you'll learn things along the way. And if your stuff doesn't detect it, then you can figure out, well, maybe that's something we want to put into a bucket to prioritize a hunt, and how we can then hunt for it, right? If our natural stack doesn't detect it. So that's what I think is great about this tool, is they just, or site, is they have a lot of that stuff there. And I also like, they even have some checklists for, like, how do you harden a Linux box, for instance. And I think they have it for Windows as well. So just kind of a good source of information that's not all offensive. And it kind of goes true to with anything. Like, you can't just be good at cyber if you only know defensive. It's kind of good to know a little bit of everything. And this site really helps with that. So yeah, that's, I think, all I got to add there. Good site.
And I think you preach it, and we preach it as well, is like, being a good blue teamer isn't just being good at defense. It's knowing what exists from a red team side or from an adversary side. So ultimately, just constantly learning. This is a good site to help you out. What you got for us?
So yeah, the last one's kind of another talking piece a little bit. It was a dark reading article, and they call it, you know, it's really a headline, right? Evil XDR researcher turns Palo Alto software into perfect malware. And I just thought this was interesting, because they're like, oh, look what happens. You know, you trust your security tools, and someone figures out how to make that security tool the one thing that's going to run your malware or help the attacker. And I hate those approaches, because any production-based software, if you're not really good at implementing least privilege in your environment, it all will be leveraged the same way, right? If an attacker focuses on figuring out how to exploit or take advantage of it. So it doesn't really matter that it's a security tool, but naturally, security tools, you kind of have to run with higher level privileges. Some of the other applications and things that get exploited that get people that access don't. So it's not necessarily someone like set something up wrong. But the mechanism is always really interesting. So there is some configuration files that this researcher found, Lua files, that help put rules and things in place with Palo's endpoint or XDR tool. And he basically figured out, well, I can't necessarily edit these files directly because they had some, like, folder access controls. But if you were to use the direct path associated, like, how the hard drive will addressing works, he can basically access those files a different way, make modifications, which would then prevent certain things from running in the tool. But also, he realized the tool loads a driver, or he's able to get the tool to load a driver for him, and it can load a malicious driver. So he's able to change some of that, the functionality of the tool that way. So kind of like a smart technique for how you could potentially manipulate something. Granted, he had to, what I liked about this was he wasn't using, as the research, he wasn't using, like, look at all these, like, fancy offensive tools and tool suites to accomplish what he's doing. He's just doing what you can do on the operating system and playing with different ways the operating system can interpret things and do things. And that's kind of how more sophisticated actors operate. They're, like, really good system admins sometimes. And I think that's, this article kind of speaks to why I think threat hunting is a thing and has to kind of coexist in an operation, because you know, if you were to try to say catch this type of attack, it might not be that easy with the tooling you specifically have, or things to that degree. So obviously you can look for loading of drivers. For instance, there's ways to monitor when drivers get loaded and see, well, what loaded them. And then it's like, well, why is Paolo loading this driver versus this other driver it normally loads? Or maybe it doesn't load drivers that often, and all of a sudden you see drivers being loaded and other endpoints that run XCR don't. Or, you know, if you know where you kind of have secure files that shouldn't be, you know, changed much, which it's going to be hard because if it sounds like if the Lua file has the rules in it, I'm sure it gets updated frequently, but then like what updates it, you know, kind of thing. So if you're able to see modifying file and what accesses happen there, there might be a way to identify these types of behaviors. But, you know, like I said, it's a interesting way to get at, I think, a really mature security tool. And the researcher did work with Paolo, and they addressed some ways for how he's able to access some things. The one thing they called out, which I thought was interesting, was the Lua files they use were in plain text. But granted, if you don't access them the right way, you wouldn't even be able to see what's in them. And if they hardened against what this researcher did, you won't be able to read them doing the same techniques he did. And so they talked about, well, should they be encrypted or not? And I think the researcher and Paolo came to the conclusion that, you know, there's no real justification to encrypt them, because if the attacker is able to manipulate the tool again, they would essentially be able to get the keys that would have to be there to then read the files anyways, or maybe find a way to do that. So, you know, might just kind of be overkill, or, you know, might not add any additional value. I sometimes sit there and think, well, there might be some logic there, and maybe the resources to spend wouldn't be justifiable, but, you know, best practice, right? In some instances, if there is data in there that you would be concerned about being changed or read, obviously encryption is important, or, you know, creating an extra burden for somebody to try to do something, you know, is always a good thing. So it was an interesting decision they came to. I can see both sides of the argument, but I don't know enough of the details from the technical side as far as what's in there and how different ways that could be used. So I can't really cast my vote. I just thought it was an interesting discussion point they brought up. But yeah, what were your thoughts?
So, and I guess this is me thinking in a very basic way, and tell me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like someone created something like that would act or mimic a rootkit for an EDR system.
Well, sort of. I wouldn't call it a rootkit because it's not behind the kernel. It's just running at the highest privileges based on something that hooks everything too. So, I mean, yeah, I guess you could make that argument, because if XDR is hooking everything it can to create the visibility and things, theoretically, depending on what you have it do after it's hooked things and you're able to leverage it, you essentially could make it have rootkit functionality.
Yeah, and that's
especially if you're relying on it for visibility and it can't see the malicious things it's doing.
Yeah, sure. That's where it kind of connected. You know, the specific and technical details, maybe this is different, but it sounds like, I mean, but being able to hide the things that you wanted to hide, you know, it sounds like something suspicious, or something close. In my mind was, you know, what other EDRs have this capability, or what other EDRs look like this or operate like this? Hopefully the answer is not a lot or no others. But I'm very curious to see, you know, in the future, or at more Black Hat events, is this going to be a thing where they're always just trying to tear apart different EDRs or different security tools to see how they can do the same thing? You know what I mean?
Well, I'm trying to remember now. There was a special care. It was one of the recent exploits that we were looking at. I think IFS. Is it IFS? Gosh, I'm trying to remember. There is a... basically, going back to like understanding operating system in a way where you can get by certain things. So, and one of the exploits we were looking at recently, people were able to leverage making a cookie that was bad, right? They could then, how it gets loaded potentially could run things. And one of the things that cookies do not allow you to do is put space characters in there. And you can't get away with like the percent 20 because it doesn't use that for encoding either. But because the backend system was a Linux system, there's a, if you put it in square brackets, I thought it was IFS, but it might be something else. Maybe it's IFD. But basically that signifies in old Linux days, a space character when you need characters to specify a space. And it's things like that that I think are where as defenders and even as new app developers trying to solve these problems with newer technologies, like we're not aware of those things unless we grew up in those days trying to use those same techniques for just to do normal work. And when people find those things, those are just hard to defend against because they exist and they'll be there for the test of time, right? Because that's what things are built on. And those are the, so I think there'll always be problems. When you talked about, you know, it's gonna be interesting to see what other tools are hit or whatever. There's always gonna be specific things that people might be able to take advantage of from an OS perspective that if people aren't aware those things still exist because they're just kind of old school, that's how they rear their ugly head.
Yeah, now I'm really all for this. I know some members of the community might not just, you know, appreciate taking advantage or reverse engineering different tools and stuff like that. And I don't know where the line is crossed for, you know, user agreement stuff. You know, because I know some applications are like, you know, they may throw a clause in there that says you can't, you know, reverse engineer, you can't modify or whatever the case may be. But if that is the case and people do it anyways, I kind of hope they get off because, they hope they don't run into legal trouble because having researchers out there that are able to do that and be able to find holes in security tools that people are selling, it shouldn't be a bad thing. Should never be defined.
It should make everyone better, right?
Right, right. And if that's the goal of your tool is to protect the community, and someone says, "Hey, there's a hole here," and you get all uppity about it and say, you know, we're taking you to court, whatever, you weren't supposed to do that, versus saying, hey, great, let's work with you to, like they did with the author here, you know, they worked with them to find a solution. That's wonderful.
Responsible disclosure, right? Like that's, I can always side with people that are trying to get the organizations to do the right thing. And then it comes down to, well, what's the only thing you have in your tool belt when they don't want to respond or they don't fix the issue is like, well, okay, I'll go public with it. And that usually is like where a lot of people get kind of like, well, I mean, should they, you know, is that the only way they could make change? Like that kind of stuff, which is an interesting conversation depending on where you sit.
Yeah. And now the one side of the things that the line that I guess I'll stand is that, you know, if you are reverse engineering to like pirate stuff, I know I'll probably get some slack from this because there's a lot of people out in the community that there's a long conversation about the digital rights and stuff like that. But if your goal is malicious and trying to make money off it, especially selling cracked versions, then yeah, that's an issue instead. Whole nother soapbox, and I don't even want to harp on that though. But yeah, good move overall. Good move by the Palo Alto team.
Yeah, it was a good article and a good cooperation and kind of an interesting find. So
I think it was a good week.
Yeah. So with that, I just really want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. With that, that closes out our top 5 threat hunting headlines for the week of April 22nd, 2024. Have a good one, everyone.
Happy hunting, everyone.
Happy hunting.
Thanks for listening to the Out of the Woods podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you heard this podcast so you never miss an episode. For more information or to connect with Cyborg Security, check us out online at www.cyborgsecurity.com and follow us on social media. We'll see you next time.